Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iran nuclear talks drag on. Greece gives Europe its latest economic reform plan. South Carolina's Confederate flag will fly no more at the state capitol.
Every time that the flag has come up, that it's been used, it has been to assert this sort of racial superiority of whites against blacks to end their civil rights.
Some sour notes hit a pair of R&B singers. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says if difficult decisions are not made on an Iran nuclear agreement, negotiators are ready to, in his words, end this process. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says he is prepared to stay on at the negotiating table in Vienna to clinch a deal with the world powers on Tehran's contested nuclear program. Two self-imposed deadlines have already passed. VOA's Heather Murdoch is in Vienna and spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about the impasse.
Secretary Kerry came out and said that they wouldn't still be negotiating if progress wasn't being made. He emphasized that any deal would have to stand the test of time. On how long they're going to continue negotiating, he was a bit vague. He said they won't rush, but they also won't go on forever, and decisions need to be made soon. He also said that the U.S. is still absolutely prepared to call an end to this process, and that's a quote. Shortly after he left, the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, came out into the balcony of the hotel, which is a bit far away, but we could just barely hear him. And the journalists were shouting, "How long are we going to stay?" And Zarif said that the Iranians were prepared to stay as long as necessary.
Well, I don't think Mr. Kerry is ready to buy a place in Vienna yet, but they have gone through two deadlines now, and presumably by time anything gets to the U.S. Congress, they're going to be in recess. So this is going to take some time, and I guess they have decided to dig in for a while.
That's what it seems like. A lot of people, including myself and my colleagues, have already extended their hotel reservations and planning to stay. I'm not sure how long. I mean, there was a lot of speculation when this process began here in Vienna this time around that if they didn't get it in by, say, the 9th of July, that it would possibly get crushed in Congress. But they wouldn't be still negotiating a deal, I think, that doesn't have a chance of surviving in the U.S.
The devil is, of course, in the details. Mm-hmm. The negotiators do not want Iran to have the capability of developing a nuclear weapon even decades down the road. So what are the sticking points at this particular juncture?
One of the main sticking points has always been how much access the IAEA would have to Iran's military sites. I mean, on one hand, they need access to figure out if Iran was, in fact, ever trying to build a bomb and keep tabs on if it would in the future. On the other hand, for a sovereign nation that is not occupied by another country to allow unfettered access to its military sites would not be realistic either. So that's where they're trying to work it out. And as I understand it, just very methodically and bit by bit, because these two ideas just oppose each other altogether. Another thing that's recently come up is the arms embargo, where they've asked for an end to the arms embargo, and that's a sticking point. But I think the sanctions relief in general is also a major sticking point, because Iranians want sanctions relief immediately, and a lot of people in the West want to make sure that the nuclear weapons are not being built and cannot be built before the relief.
VOA's Heather Murdoch in Vienna speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Time now to check out what's trending on the web. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio to bring us more on the Iran nuclear talks. Hi, G. What's new on the social media scene?
Hello, Ray. Several hours ago, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted from the talks venue. He wrote, "We're working hard, but not rushed to get the job done. Mark my words, you can't change horses in the middle of a stream." He's at Jay Zarif on Twitter, and it's also worth noting that Iranian President Hassan Rouhani retweeted that.
Can you kind of explain what that idiom means to our listeners?
Oh, yeah, of course. it means you can't back down in the middle of something. The latest deadline for nuclear negotiations between Iran and the six world powers is set for Friday. His tweet can be seen as a response to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's comment that if decisions are not made, negotiators are ready to end the process.
Has he been tweeting at all?
Yes, he has one original tweet today. He wrote, "Continuing to discuss difficult issues this a.m., working diligently to see if agreement is possible." He's on Twitter at John Kerry. He also retweeted a two-minute clip from the U.S. State Department Twitter account at State DEPT. He said in the clip, "Given that the work here is incredibly technical and that the stakes are very, very high, we will not rush and will not be rushed." The White House said President Barack Obama would bring back the U.S. negotiating team if talks don't appear to be constructive. Ray, both Kerry and Zarif used hashtag #IranTalksVienna at the end of their tweets. The social media analytics website Topsy shows that hashtag has been used more than 12,000 times in the last 24 hours. And surprisingly, hashtag #IranTalks was used even more often, with 13,000 tweets using that hashtag.
Do these ministers have any kind of influence on social media?
Yes, they do. That's a very interesting question. At first glance, it appears Kerry has more clout because he has 551,000 followers on Twitter. That's almost double the number of followers Zarif has. But if you look at their latest tweets regarding the nuclear talks, Zarif's tweet has been retweeted more than 1,000 times and marked as a favorite nearly 2,000 times. Kerry's, which was actually tweeted even earlier, was retweeted and marked as a favorite around 400 times.
I guess more followers doesn't always equal more retweets. Thanks for bringing us the update. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Greece delivered its latest proposal for economic reforms to European finance ministers, who must decide whether they will grant the struggling government another desperately needed bailout. Little information is available about what is in the new package from Athens, but reports say it includes EU demands for a boost in sales taxes and cuts in spending. The Greek parliament will meet today to decide whether to endorse the reforms, and the entire 28-member European Union will hold an emergency summit on the Greek situation Sunday. Some EU leaders are calling this absolutely Greece's last chance to satisfy their demands. As the future of Greece in the Eurozone is debated, the economic arguments seem distant for many Greeks living in poverty. 5 years of government spending cuts have had a huge impact on public services. Henry Ridgewell reports from Athens.
The waiting area at the free clinic run by Doctors of the World in Athens is a cross-section of Greece's poorest, the homeless, the elderly, the unemployed, alongside dozens of immigrants who have landed on Greek shores. Inside this dental clinic, volunteer doctors and dentists treat everyone, no questions asked, but their resources are limited and they are struggling to cope. Dr. Bettina Krumpholz says the health system started to crumble when the debt crisis began in 2008.
We used to have a very good system and really used to work quite efficient. But after, they had to fire so many doctors, the system got very poor. I mean, there are a lack of nurses, there's a lack of doctors. So the people cannot be really cured. They're waiting for 10, 12, even more hours in the line.
Krumholtz says the restrictions on cash withdrawals over the past 2 weeks have made the situation worse.
They don't have money to get the medicine. So we have even many Greek patients, they come here not only to get the medication. We cannot leave people dying on the streets. This out of hunger, out of a lack of medication, of medicine, out of lack of doctors.
Solidarity is the battle cry of Greeks who fight the crisis by offering their services for free for healthcare, legal advice, food. In Athens' central Manastiraki Square, in the shadow of the Acropolis, 51-year-old Konstantinos Polychronopoulos stirs a large pot of chicken stew as other volunteers ready plates and cutlery at the self-styled social kitchen. Polychronopoulos lost his job as a marketing executive 4 years ago and was told repeatedly at interviews that he was too old or overqualified. He now offers free meals to anyone, rich or poor. I started the social kitchen when I saw two small boys having a fight over a piece of food in front of a garbage dump, he says. This did not bother me so much. What bothered me more was the fact that people were passing by without showing any interest, acting like they did not see it. Even if there is a bailout deal, the economic hardship will continue for many Greeks, the victims of a debt crisis that has taken a huge toll on the nation's poorest. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Athens.
The United States is at the forefront in the battle against terrorism, especially following the attacks in New York and Washington on September 11, 2001. Our colleagues at Al Jura Television spoke with Richard Stengel, Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. In excerpts from the conversation, he describes some ways the United States is addressing the threat.
In a strange, perverse way almost, terrorism tends to unite people. And I think what happened on 9/11 was something that united people in the world against terrorism, made them realize the United States is also a victim of terrorism. And I would say that our alliances and friendships with people in the Arab world have only grown since then.
The rise of ISIS, how can this problem be dealt with?
Well, we're dealing with it in all kinds of ways. There is the military battlefield where we have rolled back a lot of their advances and where the bombing raids are effective and they represent a cohesion among the partners and the Arab partners. And then there's also the information battlefield, which is the battlefield that I operate on. And I think since the rise of ISIS or ISIL or Daesh a year ago, there have been a lot more actors that have come into the fray. Arab countries now have mobilized their own social media, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. As you know, we launched the Sawab Center with the Emiratis, and that is a big new endeavor, which I think will inspire other people in other countries to create similar centers.
We were talking about Sawab Center. What is the goal of launching this Sawab Center?
It's a joint Emirati-American project that will then help coordinate among the coalition partners to create content messages that counter Daesh's social media strength and sophistication, that also present a positive alternative to that negative vision that they are presenting, and also will coordinate the messaging and content from among the coalition partners that are united against Daesh.
After the attack of Paris and Kuwait, some made it clear that U.S. could be a terrorist target. What do you think?
You know, we're all potential targets. Nobody is immune. And we saw that situation in Texas where there was a kind of lone wolf actor. And certainly people in America are concerned that America itself could be a target. But I don't think it's quite an existential issue for America the way it is for countries in the region where it's on your border and they are advancing and they are trying to create a state. So I think the problem is more acute here, but everybody has the problem as well. There are foreign fighters that come from the U.S. too. So it's something that everybody needs to be concerned with.
U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Richard Stengel. The Dalai Lama is in New York City, where he's been celebrating his 80th birthday. The Tibetan spiritual leader appeared at the Javits Center Thursday, where there will be more ceremonies and festivities today. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with International Edition Sarah Williams about the Dalai Lama's visit.
This whole center is filled with mostly Tibetan people, many of whom are in traditional dress, very, very colorful. You can tell the married women because they've got a certain kind of apron that they wear. And there's also kind of a festive atmosphere. Kids are running around. The PA system is not of the best, but I don't think people really mind that much. He's actually giving a very learned lecture on compassion and action in the world. He's well-known as sort of a prince of peace and that kind of thing. He got the Nobel Peace Prize, as you know. But he's also a great scholar, and he knows a lot about Buddhism, esoteric Buddhism, and explaining it to his followers, of whom there are many millions around the world.
Yes, he's certainly very popular in this country, and I believe began this visit in California.
He usually comes every year, usually about this time of year, and there's 2 days here. It happens to be his 80th birthday this week. So today is a whole day of gratitude and ceremony and celebration of him, which will be visited by many, many Americans and other people who just think he's great religiously, spiritually, and as a sort of as a role model about how to act in the face of conflicts of equanimity. That's his big calling card in life, this life, because he's been born many times before, if you believe his believers.
Are there any people there protesting his visit?
I have not seen any. I know that there has been a little bit of that lately. I've been getting emails and stuff like that as a reporter for people who say that he's sort of persecuting Buddhist minorities. I haven't seen any evidence either of the protesters or seen anything that he said that would indicate that he actually is doing persecution. But the shorter answer is no. I don't see any protesters around this site. Especially.
And what is the security like there?
It's pretty tight. I had to go through many, many hoops and lots of press credentials and photographs in order to get this golden pass that I've got, this all-access pass. And there's a metal detector like you see at airports, and there's some very seriously looking furrowed brows among official types with the squiggly wires going into the ears just to make sure everything's okay and that the man at peace can have peace while he gets his talk.
VOA's Adam Phillips in New York speaking with International Edition Sarah Williams. The Dalai Lama fled into exile from Chinese-controlled Tibet back in 1959. This is VOA. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley signed into law a measure to remove the Confederate battle flag from the state capitol building. Her act culminated a years-long movement that was reignited last month by the racially motivated murders of 9 members of a historically black Charleston church. The flag will be pulled down from its pole at a ceremony today. Governor Haley says the flag will be lowered and taken away with dignity and put in its rightful place in a museum. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Jonathan Blanks of the Cato Institute in Washington why the Confederate flag remains such an emotional symbol, especially in the southern United States.
I think it goes back to the fact that a lot of people in this country don't want to admit what the Civil War was over. Shortly after the war ended, there started a sort of revisionist history of what the war was about, that it was about states' rights or tariffs or honor. And the South, being humiliated in the war and defeated, wanted something to hold on to. And so years later, when the Civil Rights Movement happened, they brought the flag back. And they're like, this is what we're about. You're not going to take us down again. And they've just latched on to it. Unfortunately, the war was about slavery, and the rest of the country still views it very much that way.
So what we have here is, on the surface, a presentation of this is our heritage, but what I get is a subcontext where this means something else entirely. Why don't you explain that?
After the war ended, the federal government put in Reconstruction in the South. That meant the federal government basically took control of the governments there and protected the rights of the freed blacks there. After that ended, the white majorities reinstituted their old laws, not in slavery per se, but stripped the right to vote, stripped the rights of black citizens. And that's when you saw the reinstitution of the Confederate battle flag in the state flag of Mississippi, for example. And then years later, when the Civil Rights Movement came up, that's when you started to see them again in protests against integration, desegregation, and the like.
we have a situation now in the United States where it is very clear that this flag is no longer acceptable to a large number of Americans. And yet there are people that are still clinging to it and saying, well, my great-great-great-granddaddy fought in the Civil War, and this is the flag he fought under, etc. But at this point, isn't it really about other things? Aren't there larger socio issues involved here?
Yes, because every time that the flag has come up that it's been used, it has been to assert this sort of racial superiority of whites against blacks to end their civil rights. But what was really interesting to me is in South Carolina, a descendant of Jefferson Davis actually called for the flag to come down from their capital, which is, I think, great. But the history has just been a pick-and-choose history by the flag's defenders instead of recognizing the flag and the war for what it really meant.
Do you think it's possible that this thing can finally be put to rest and that people can let go? Or do you think, just from what you know and from what you see, that this controversy is going to continue to drag on?
I think it will drag on in, you know, pockets here and there. People are going to stick to it because there's not going to be any law saying that the flag is illegal. The First Amendment protects the right to fly it. It's just a question of whether or not it's going to be on government property. I think there's still going to be pockets here and there, and there's going to be fights over that. But generally speaking, it looks like, particularly in South Carolina, this is coming down. Mississippi will be a new fight, and there will still be fights on whether or not federal lands, that, like cemeteries and such, that have Confederate soldiers buried there, whether or not they'll still be selling Confederate merchandise and whatnot.
Jonathan Blanks of the Cato Institute in Washington talking with VOA's Jeffrey Young. A possible feud could be brewing between R&B stars Frank Ocean and Miguel. International Edition's David Byrd talked with VOA's Soul Lounge host Jonah Reed about the quarrel.
There's an old proverb that says that as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But when it's the music business and you say, hey, I make better music than you do, that's not exactly the same thing. But that's what's going on with Miguel and Frank Ocean. Shonda Renee joins us in the studio to talk about these two young men. First of all, let's give a little background here. This all kind of started when Frank Ocean won the Grammy and Miguel and Chris Brown didn't.
Right. This happened back in 2013. They were all up for the Best Urban Contemporary Album category. And Frank Ocean kind of came out of nowhere. At the time, Miguel was very popular. Of course, Chris Brown was hugely popular. So to have Frank Ocean win this award was very shocking, surprising, and obviously a bit upsetting for Miguel. Now, Frank Ocean got a standing ovation. Miguel would not stand. And that sort of began this rumor. It was the start of the rumor that perhaps there was something personal going on between these two men.
And then Miguel gave an interview in which he said, you know, frankly, I make better music than you do.
He did. He gave an interview with the Sunday Times recently, and he was asked, we're not friends. And to be completely honest, and I'm quoting now, and no disrespect to anyone, I genuinely believe that I make better music all the way around. We've talked street art, sarcasm, crass humor in high fashion. Peach color moon glisses, the plot thickens as we laugh off of shotguns and tongue kisses. Bubble bath. And so this quote kind of took off and Twitter exploded. And it was like, oh, are these fighting words? Really? Are we now having beef and rivalries in R&B? Because this is something that traditionally is reserved for hip-hop music.
Right.
We never see it in R&B, and you especially don't see it in more contemporary R&B because it's just a different brand, a different feel. So everyone was a little concerned and confused, but then also excited about the fact that finally something's happening in this genre that is of interest. And Frank Ocean is working on a new project. Miguel has a new album out now, so it has piqued the interest of folks who may not have otherwise thought to check out either of these gentlemen.
And he was asked, Miguel was asked, if he had the chance to do it again, would you go back and give Frank Ocean the standing ovation? And he said no.
He said no. No, he said no.
Now, this is a little bit of talking smack. I mean, you know, this is okay if you're, you know, LeBron James or if you're in the NFL or, like, if you're in hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, but most of the time when you're talking about guys that make this kind of music, it's all more kind of laid back and everybody's a little bit, you know, more relaxed, but apparently not.
apparently there's a little bit of tension going on here.
Well, and hopefully it'll be good for both of them, because in hip hop, that's what the battles were about. The beef was about making sure that both artists stayed on top of their game, encouraging them to be better, to push boundaries. And both Miguel and Frank Ocean have already done that. So if they can use this to continue to expand the genre and their own careers, I think we'll all come out winners for it.
All right. So what do you think about this? You can let Shauna know by sending her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ on Twitter. She's also at VOA underscore music if you want to just reach everybody in the music department. You can also listen for Shauna in the Soul Lounge by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more words, pictures, and sound on all kinds of news and information at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersey, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.